Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond continued. Cassette 4, Side 2. Thus, the food production package quickly became superior to the hunter-gatherer package. Sedentary villages based on cereals were already in existence before the rise of food production, and predisposed those hunter-gatherers to agriculture and herding. In the Fertile Crescent, the transition from hunting-gathering to food production took place relatively fast, as late as 9000 BC. People still had no crops and domestic animals, and were entirely dependent on wild foods. But by 6000 BC, some societies were almost completely dependent on crops and domestic animals. The situation in Mesoamerica contrasts strongly. That area provided only two domesticable animals, the turkey and the dog, whose meat yield was far lower than that of cows, sheep, goats, and pigs. And corn, Mesoamerica's staple grain, was, as I've already explained, difficult to domesticate and perhaps slow to develop. As a result, domestication may not have begun in Mesoamerica until around 3500 BC. The date remains very uncertain. Those first developments were undertaken by people who were still nomadic hunter-gatherers, and settled villages did not arise there until around 1500 BC. In all this discussion of the Fertile Crescent's advantages for the early rise of food production, we have not had to invoke any supposed advantages of Fertile Crescent peoples themselves. Indeed, I am unaware of anyone's even seriously suggesting any supposed distinctive biological features of the region's peoples that might have contributed to the potency of its food production package. Instead, we have seen that the many distinctive features of the Fertile Crescent's climate, environment, wild plants, and animals together provide a convincing explanation. Since the food production packages arising indigenously in New Guinea and in the eastern United States were considerably less potent, might the explanation there lie with the peoples of those areas? Before turning to those regions, however, we must consider two related questions arising in regard to any area of the world where food production never developed independently or else resulted in a less potent package. First, do hunter-gatherers and incipient farmers really know well all locally available wild species and their uses? Or might they have overlooked potential ancestors of valuable crops? Second, if they do know their local plants and animals, do they exploit that knowledge to domesticate the most useful available species? Or do cultural factors keep them from doing so? As regards the first question, an entire field of science, termed ethnobiology, studies people's knowledge of the wild plants and animals in their environment. Such studies have concentrated especially on the world's few surviving hunting-gathering peoples and on farming peoples who still depend heavily on wild foods and natural products. The studies generally show that such peoples are walking encyclopedias of natural history, with individual names in their local language, for as many as 1,000 or more plant and animal species, and with detailed knowledge of those species' biological characteristics, distribution, and potential uses. As people become increasingly dependent on domesticated plants and animals, this traditional knowledge gradually loses its value and becomes lost, until one arrives at modern supermarket shoppers who could not distinguish a wild grass from a wild pulse. Here's a typical example. For the last 33 years, while conducting biological exploration in New Guinea, I have been spending my field time there constantly in the company of New Guineans who still use wild plants and animals extensively. One day, when my companions of the Foray tribe and I were starving in the jungle because another tribe was blocking our return to our supply base, a Foray man returned to camp with a large rucksack full of mushrooms he had found and started to roast them. Dinner at last, but then I had an unsettling thought. What if the mushrooms were poisonous? I patiently explained to my Foray companions that I had read about some mushrooms being poisonous, that I had heard of even expert American mushroom collectors dying because of the difficulty of distinguishing safe from dangerous mushrooms, and that although we were all hungry, it just wasn't worth the risk. At that point, my companions got angry and told me to shut up and listen while they explained some things to me. After I had been quizzing them for years about names of hundreds of trees and birds, how could I insult them by assuming they didn't have names for different mushrooms? Only Americans could be so stupid as to confuse poisonous mushrooms with safe ones. They went on to lecture me about the 29 types of edible mushroom species, each species name in the Foray language, and where in the forest one should look for it. This one, the tanti, grew on trees, and it was delicious and perfectly edible. Whenever I have taken New Guineans with me to other parts of their island, they regularly talk about local plants and animals with other New Guineans whom they meet. And they gather potentially useful plants and bring them back to their home villages to try planting them. My experiences with New Guineans are paralleled by those of ethnobiologists studying traditional peoples elsewhere. However, all such peoples either practice at least some food production or are the partly acculturated last remnants of the world's former hunter-gatherer societies. Knowledge of wild species was presumably even more detailed before the rise of food production, when everyone on Earth still depended entirely on wild species for food. The first farmers were heirs to that knowledge, accumulated through tens of thousands of years of nature observation by biologically modern humans living in intimate dependence on the natural world. It therefore seems extremely unlikely that wild species of potential value would have escaped the notice of the first farmers. The other related question is whether ancient hunter-gatherers and farmers similarly put their ethnobiological knowledge to good use in selecting wild plants to gather and eventually to cultivate. One test comes from an archaeological site at the edge of the Euphrates Valley in Syria, called Tel Abu Huraira. Between 10,000 and 9,000 BC, the people living there may already have been residing year-round in villages, but they were still hunter-gatherers. Crop cultivation began only in the succeeding millennium. The archaeologists Gordon Hillman, Susan College, and David Harris retrieved large quantities of charred plant remains from the site, probably representing discarded garbage of wild plants gathered elsewhere and brought to the site by its residents. The scientists analyzed over 700 samples, each containing an average of over 500 identifiable seeds belonging to over 70 plant species. It turned out that the villagers were collecting a prodigious variety, 157 species of plants identified by their charred seeds, not to mention other plants that cannot now be identified. Were those naive villagers collecting every type of seed plant that they found, bringing it home, poisoning themselves on most of the species, and nourishing themselves from only a few species? No, they were not so silly. While 157 species sounds like indiscriminate collecting, many more species growing wild in the vicinity were absent from the charred remains. The 157 selected species fall into three categories. Many of them have seeds that are non-poisonous and immediately edible. Others, such as pulses and members of the mustard family, have toxic seeds, but the toxins are easily removed, leaving the seeds edible. A few seeds belong to species traditionally used as sources of dyes or medicine. The many wild species not represented among the 157 selected are ones that would have been useless or harmful to people, including all of the most toxic weed species in the environment. Thus, the hunter-gatherers of Tel Abu Huraira were not wasting time and endangering themselves by collecting wild plants indiscriminately. Instead, they evidently knew the local wild plants as intimately as do modern New Guineans. And they use that knowledge to select and bring home only the most useful available seed plants. But those gathered seeds would have constituted the material for the unconscious first steps of plant domestication. My other example of how ancient peoples apparently used their ethnobiological knowledge to good effect comes from the Jordan Valley in the 9th millennium BC, the period of the earliest crop cultivation there. The valley's first domesticated cereals were barley and emmer wheat, which are still among the world's most productive crops today. But, as at Tel Abu Huraira, hundreds of other seed-bearing wild plant species must have grown in the vicinity, and 100 or more of them would have been edible and gathered before the rise of plant domestication. What was it about barley and emmer wheat that caused them to be the first crops? Were those first Jordan Valley farmers botanical ignoramuses who didn't know what they were doing? Or were barley and emmer wheat actually the best of the local wild cereals that they could have selected? Two Israeli scientists, Ofer Bar Yosef and Mordechai Kislev, tackled this question by examining the wild grass species still growing wild in the valley today. Leaving aside species with small or unpalatable seeds, they picked out 23 of the most palatable and largest seeded wild grasses. Not surprisingly, barley and emmer wheat were on that list. But it wasn't true that the 21 other candidates would have been equally useful. Among those 23, barley and emmerwheat proved to be the best by many criteria. Emmerwheat has the biggest seeds, and barley the second biggest. In the wild, barley is one of the foremost abundant of the 23 species, while emmerwheat is of medium abundance. Barley has the further advantage that its genetics and morphology permit it to evolve quickly the useful changes in seed dispersal and germination inhibition that we discussed in the preceding chapter. Emmerwheat, however, has compensating virtues. It can be gathered more efficiently than barley, and it is unusual among cereals in that its seeds do not adhere to husks. As for the other 21 species, their drawbacks include smaller seeds, in many cases lower abundance, and in some cases, there being perennial rather than annual plants, with the consequence that they would have evolved only slowly under domestication. Thus, the first farmers in the Jordan Valley selected the two very best of the 23 best wild grass species available to them. Of course, the evolutionary changes following cultivation in seed dispersal and germination inhibition would have been unforeseen consequences of what those first farmers were doing. But their initial selection of barley and emmerwheat rather than other cereals to collect, bring home, and cultivate would have been conscious, and based on the easily detected criteria of seed size, palatability, and abundance. This example from the Jordan Valley, like that from Tel Abu Huraira, illustrates that the first farmers and their detailed knowledge of local species to their own benefit. Knowing far more about local plants than all but a handful of modern professional botanists, they would hardly have failed to cultivate any useful wild plant species that was comparably suitable for domestication. We can now examine what local farmers in two parts of the world, New Guinea and the eastern United States, with indigenous but apparently deficient food production systems compared to that of the Fertile Crescent, actually did when more productive crops arrived from elsewhere. If it turned out that such crops did not become adopted for cultural or other reasons, we would be left with a nagging doubt. Despite all our reasoning so far, we would still have to suspect that the local wild flora harbored some ancestor of a potential valuable crop that local farmers failed to exploit because of similar cultural factors. These two examples will also demonstrate in detail a fact critical to history, that indigenous crops from different parts of the globe were not equally productive. New Guinea, the largest island in the world after Greenland, lies just north of Australia and near the equator. Because of its tropical location and great diversity in topography and habitats, New Guinea is rich in both plant and animal species, though less so than continental tropical areas, because it is an island. People have been living in New Guinea for at least 40,000 years, much longer than in the Americas, and slightly longer than anatomically modern peoples have been living in Western Europe. Thus, New Guineans have had ample opportunity to get to know their local flora and fauna. Were they motivated to apply this knowledge to developing food production? I mentioned already that the adoption of food production involved a competition between the food-producing and the hunting-gathering lifestyles. Hunting-gathering is not so rewarding in New Guinea as to remove the motivation to develop food production. In particular, modern New Guinea hunters suffer from the crippling disadvantage of a dearth of wild game. There is no native land animal larger than a 100-pound flightless bird, the cassowary, and a 50-pound kangaroo. Lowland New Guineans on the coast do obtain much fish and shellfish, and some lowlanders in the interior still live today as hunter-gatherers, subsisting especially on wild sago palms. But no peoples still live as hunter-gatherers in the New Guinea highlands. All modern highlanders are instead farmers, who use wild foods only to supplement their diets. When highlanders go into the forest on hunting trips, they take along garden-grown vegetables to feed themselves. If they have the misfortune to run out of those provisions, even they starve to death despite their detailed knowledge of locally available wild foods. Since the hunting-gathering lifestyle is thus non-viable in much of modern New Guinea, it comes as no surprise that all New Guinea highlanders, and most lowlanders today, are settled farmers with sophisticated systems of food production. Extensive, formerly forested areas of the highlands were converted by traditional New Guinea farmers to fenced, drained, intensively managed field systems supporting dense human populations. Archaeological evidence shows that the origins of New Guinea agriculture are ancient, dating to around 7,000 BC. At those early dates, all the land masses surrounding New Guinea were still occupied exclusively by hunter-gatherers. So this ancient agriculture must have developed independently in New Guinea. While unequivocal remains of crops have not been removed from those early fields, they are likely to have included some of the same crops that were being grown in New Guinea at the time of European colonization and that are now known to have been domesticated locally from wild New Guinea ancestors. Foremost among these local domesticates is the modern world's leading crop, sugarcane, of which the annual tonnage produced today nearly equals that of the number two and number three crops combined, wheat and corn. Other crops of undoubted New Guinea origin are a group of bananas known as Australimusa bananas, the nut tree Cinarium indicum, and giant swamp taro, as well as various edible grass stems, roots, and green vegetables. The breadfruit tree and the root crops yams and ordinary taro may also be New Guinean domesticates, although that conclusion remains uncertain because their wild ancestors are not confined to New Guinea but are distributed from New Guinea to Southeast Asia. At present, we lack evidence that could resolve the question whether they were domesticated in Southeast Asia, as traditionally assumed, or independently, or even only in New Guinea. However, it turns out that New Guinea's biota suffered from three severe limitations. First, no cereal crops were domesticated in New Guinea, whereas several vitally important ones were domesticated in the Fertile Crescent, Sahel, and China. In its emphasis instead on root and tree crops, New Guinea carries to an extreme a trend seen in agricultural systems in other wet tropical areas, the Amazon, tropical West Africa, and Southeast Asia, whose farmers also emphasized root crops but did manage to come up with at least two cereals, Asian rice, and a giant-seeded Asian cereal called Job's Tears. A likely reason for the failure of cereal agriculture to arise in New Guinea is a glaring deficiency of the wild starting material. Not one of the world's 56 largest seeded wild grasses is native there. Second, the New Guinea fauna included no domesticable large mammal species whatsoever. The sole domestic animals of modern New Guinea, the pig, the chicken, and dog, arrived from Southeast Asia by way of Indonesia within the last several thousand years. As a result, while New Guinea lowlanders obtain protein from the fish they catch, New Guinea highland farmer populations suffer from severe protein limitation because the staple crops that provide most of their calories, taro and sweet potato, are low in protein. Taro, for example, consists of barely 1% protein, much worse than even white rice, and far below the levels of the Fertile Crescent's wheats and pulses, 8 to 14% and 20 to 25% protein, respectively. Children in the New Guinea highlands have the swollen bellies characteristic of a high-bulk but protein-deficient diet. New Guineans old and young routinely eat mice, spiders, frogs, and other small animals that peoples elsewhere with access to large domestic animals or large wild game species do not bother to eat. Protein starvation is probably also the ultimate reason why cannibalism was widespread in traditional New Guinea highland societies. Finally, in former times, New Guinea's available root crops were limiting for calories as well as for protein, because they do not grow well at the high elevations where many New Guineans live today. Many centuries ago, however, a new root crop of ultimately South American origin, the sweet potato, reached New Guinea, probably by way of the Philippines, where it had been introduced by Spaniards. Compared with taro and other presumably older New Guinea root crops, the sweet potato can be grown up to higher elevations, grows more quickly, and gives higher yields per acre cultivated and per hour of labor. The result of the sweet potato's arrival was a highland population explosion. That is, even though people had been farming in the New Guinea highlands for many thousands of years before sweet potatoes were introduced, the available local crops had limited them in the population densities they could attain and in the elevations they could occupy. In short, New Guinea offers an instructive contrast to the Fertile Crescent. Like hunter-gatherers of the Fertile Crescent, those of New Guinea did evolve food production independently. However, their indigenous food production was restricted by the local absence of domesticable cereals, pulses, and animals, by the resulting protein deficiency in the highlands, and by limitations of the locally available root crops at high elevations. Yet New Guineans themselves know as much about the wild plants and animals available to them as any peoples on Earth today. They can be expected to have discovered and tested any wild plant species worth domesticating. They are perfectly capable of recognizing useful additions to their crop larder, as is shown by their exuberant adoption of the sweet potato when it arrived. That same lesson is being driven home again in New Guinea today, as those tribes with preferential access to introduced new crops and livestock, or with the cultural willingness to adopt them, expand at the expense of tribes without that access or willingness. Thus, the limits on indigenous food production in New Guinea had nothing to do with New Guinea peoples and everything with the New Guinea biota and environment. Our other example of indigenous agriculture, apparently constrained by the local flora, comes from the eastern United States. Like New Guinea, that area supported independent domestication of local wild plants. However, early developments are much better understood for the eastern United States than for New Guinea. The crops grown by the earliest farmers have been identified, and the dates and crop sequences of local domestication are known. Well before other crops began to arrive from elsewhere, Native Americans settled in the eastern United States river valleys and developed intensified food production based on local crops. Hence, they were in a position to take advantage of the most promising wild plants. Which ones did they actually cultivate? And how did the resulting local crop package compare with the Fertile Crescent's founder package? It turns out that the eastern United States founder crops were four plants domesticated in the period 2500 to 1500 BC, a full 6,000 years after wheat and barley domestication in the Fertile Crescent. A local species of squash provided small containers, as well as yielding edible seeds. The remaining three founders were grown solely for their edible seeds. Sunflower, a daisy relative called sumpweed, and a distant relative of spinach called goosefoot. But four seed crops and a container fall far short of a complete food production package. For 2,000 years, those founder crops served only as minor dietary supplements, while eastern United States Native Americans continued to depend mainly on wild foods, especially wild mammals and water birds, fish, shellfish, and nuts. Farming did not supply a major part of their diet until the period 500 to 200 BC. After three more seed crops, knotweed, maygrass, and little barley, had been brought into cultivation. A modern nutritionist would have applauded those seven eastern U.S. crops. All of them were high in protein, 17% to 32%, compared with 8% to 14% for wheat, 9% for corn, and even lower for barley and white rice. Two of them, sunflower and sumpweed, were also high in oil, 45% to 47%. Sumpweed in particular would have been a nutritionist's ultimate dream, being 32% protein and 45% oil. Why aren't we still eating those dream foods today? Alas, despite their nutritional advantage, most of these eastern U.S. crops suffered from serious disadvantages in other respects. Goosefoot, knotweed, little barley, and maygrass had tiny seeds, with volumes only one-tenth that of wheat and barley seeds. Worse yet, sumpweed is a wind-pollinated relative of ragweed, the notorious hay fever-causing plant. Like ragweeds, sumpweed's pollen can cause hay fever where the plant occurs in abundant stands. If that doesn't kill your enthusiasm for becoming a sumpweed farmer, be aware that it has a strong odor objectionable to some people and that handling it can cause skin irritation. Mexican crops finally began to reach the eastern United States by trade routes after AD 1. Corn arrived around AD 200, but its role remained very minor for many centuries. Finally, around AD 900, a new variety of corn adapted to North America's short summers appeared, and the arrival of beans around AD 1100 completed Mexico's crop trinity of corn, beans, and squash. Eastern U.S. farming became greatly intensified, and densely populated chiefdoms developed along the Mississippi River and its tributaries. In some areas, the original local domesticates were retained alongside the far more productive Mexican trinity, but in other areas, the trinity replaced them completely. No European ever saw sumpweed growing in Indian gardens, because it had disappeared as a crop by the time that European colonization of the Americas began in AD 1492. Among all those ancient eastern U.S. crop specialties, only two, sunflower and eastern squash, have been able to compete with crops domesticated elsewhere and are still grown today. Our modern acorn squashes and summer squashes are derived from those American squashes domesticated thousands of years ago. Thus, like the case of New Guinea, that of the eastern United States is instructive. A priori, the region might have seemed a likely one to support productive indigenous agriculture. It has rich soils, reliable moderate rainfall, and a suitable climate that sustains bountiful agriculture today. The flora is a species-rich one that includes productive wild nut trees, oak and hickory. Local Native Americans did develop an agriculture based on local domesticates, did thereby support themselves in villages, and even developed a cultural florescence. The Hopewell culture centered on what is today Ohio, around 200 BC to 400 AD. They were thus in a position for several thousand years to exploit as potential crops the most useful available wild plants, whatever those should be. Nevertheless, the Hopewell florescence sprang up nearly 9,000 years after the rise of village living in the Fertile Crescent. Still, it was not until after AD 900 that the assembly of the Mexican crop trinity triggered a larger population boom, the so-called Mississippian florescence, which produced the largest towns and most complex societies achieved by Native Americans north of Mexico. But that boom came much too late to prepare Native Americans of the United States for the impending disaster of European colonization. Food production based on eastern U.S. crops alone had been insufficient to trigger the boom, for reasons that are easy to specify. The area's available wild cereals were not nearly as useful as wheat and barley. Native Americans of the eastern United States domesticated no locally available wild pulse, no fiber crop, no fruit or nut tree. They had no domesticated animals at all except for dogs, which were probably domesticated elsewhere in the Americas. It's also clear that Native Americans of the eastern United States were not overlooking potential major crops among the wild species around them. Even 20th century plant breeders, armed with all the power of modern science, have had little success in exploiting North American wild plants. Yes, we have now domesticated pecans as a nut tree and blueberries as a fruit, and we have improved some Eurasian fruit crops, apples, plums, grapes, raspberries, blackberries, strawberries, by hybridizing them with North American wild relatives. However, those few successes have changed our food habits far less than Mexican corn changed food habits of Native Americans in the eastern United States after AD 900. The farmers most knowledgeable about eastern U.S. domesticates, the region's Native Americans themselves, passed judgment on them by discarding or de-emphasizing them when the Mexican Trinity arrived. That outcome also demonstrates that Native Americans were not constrained by cultural conservatism and were quite able to appreciate a good plant when they saw it. Thus, as in New Guinea, the limitations on indigenous food production in the eastern United States were not due to Native American peoples themselves, but instead depended entirely on the American biota and environment. We have now considered examples of three contrasting areas, in all of which food production did arise indigenously. The Fertile Crescent lies at one extreme. New Guinea and the eastern United States lie at the opposite extreme. Peoples of the Fertile Crescent domesticated local plants much earlier. They domesticated far more species, domesticated far more productive or valuable species, domesticated a much wider range of types of crops, developed intensified food production, and dense human populations more rapidly. And as a result, entered the modern world with more advanced technology, more complex political organization, and more epidemic diseases with which to infect other peoples. We found that these differences between the Fertile Crescent, New Guinea, and the eastern United States followed straightforwardly from the differing suites of wild plant and animal species available for domestication, not from limitations of the peoples themselves. When more productive crops arrived from elsewhere, the sweet potato in New Guinea, the Mexican Trinity in the eastern United States, local peoples promptly took advantage of them, intensified food production, and increased greatly in population. By extension, I suggest that areas of the globe where food production never developed indigenously at all, California, Australia, the Argentine Pampas, Western Europe, and so on, may have offered even less in the way of wild plants and animals suitable for domestication than did New Guinea and the eastern United States, where at least a limited food production did arise. Indeed, Mark Blumler's worldwide survey of locally available large-seeded wild grasses mentioned in this chapter and the worldwide survey of locally available big mammals to be presented in the next chapter agree in showing that all those areas of non-existent or limited indigenous food production were deficient in wild ancestors of domesticable livestock and cereals. Recall that the rise of food production involved a competition between food production and hunting-gathering. One might therefore wonder whether all these cases of slow or non-existent rise of food production might instead have been due to an exceptional local richness of resources to be hunted and gathered, rather than to an exceptional availability of species suitable for domestication. In fact, most areas where indigenous food production arose late or not at all offered exceptionally poor rather than rich resources to hunter-gatherers, because most large mammals of Australia and the Americas, but not of Eurasia and Africa, had become extinct toward the end of the Ice Ages. Food production would have faced even less competition from hunting-gathering in these areas than it did in the Fertile Crescent. Hence, these local failures or limitations of food production cannot be attributed to competition from bountiful hunting opportunities. Lest these conclusions be misinterpreted, we should end this chapter with caveats against exaggerating two points: people's readiness to accept better crops and livestock, and the constraints imposed by locally available wild plants and animals. Neither that readiness nor those constraints are absolute. We've already discussed many examples of local peoples adopting more productive crops domesticated elsewhere. Our broad conclusion is that people can recognize useful plants, would therefore have probably recognized better local ones suitable for domestication if any had existed, and aren't barred from doing so by cultural conservatism or taboos. But a big qualifier must be added to this sentence: in the long run and over large areas. Anyone knowledgeable about human societies can cite innumerable examples of societies that refused crops, livestock, and other innovations that would have been productive. Naturally, I don't subscribe to the obvious fallacy that every society promptly adopts every innovation that would be useful for it. The fact is that over entire continents and other large areas containing hundreds of competing societies, some societies will be more open to innovation, and some will be more resistant. The ones that do adopt new crops, livestock, or technology may thereby be enabled to nourish themselves better and to outbreed, displace, conquer, or kill off societies resisting innovation. That's an important phenomenon whose manifestations extend far beyond the adoption of new crops, and to which we shall return in Chapter 13. Our other caveat concerns the limits that locally available wild species set on the rise of food production. I'm not saying that food production could never, in any amount of time, have arisen in all those areas where it actually had not arisen indigenously by modern times. Europeans today, who note that Aboriginal Australians entered the modern world as Stone Age hunter-gatherers, often assume that the Aborigines would have gone on that way forever. To appreciate the fallacy, consider a visitor from outer space who dropped in on Earth in the year 3000 BC. The spaceling would have observed no food production in the eastern United States, because food production did not begin there until around 2500 BC. Had the visitor of 3000 BC drawn the conclusion that limitations posed by the wild plants and animals of the eastern United States foreclosed food production there forever, events of the subsequent millennium would have proved the visitor wrong. Even a visitor to the Fertile Crescent in 9500 BC rather than in 8500 BC could have been misled into supposing the Fertile Crescent permanently unsuitable for food production. That is, my thesis is not that California, Australia, Western Europe, and all the other areas without indigenous food production were devoid of domesticable species and would have continued to be occupied just by hunter-gatherers indefinitely if foreign domesticates or peoples had not arrived. Instead, I note that regions differed greatly in their available pool of domesticable species, that they varied correspondingly in the date when local food production arose, and that food production had not yet arisen independently in some fertile regions as of modern times. Australia, supposedly the most backward continent, illustrates this point well. In southeastern Australia, the well-watered part of the continent most suitable for food production, Aboriginal societies in recent millennia appear to have been evolving on a trajectory that would eventually have led to indigenous food production. They had already built winter villages. They had begun to manage their environment intensively for fish production by building fish traps, nets, and even long canals. Had Europeans not colonized Australia in 1788 and aborted that independent trajectory, Aboriginal Australians might, within a few thousand years, have become food producers, tending ponds of domesticated fish, and growing domesticated Australian yams and small seeded grasses. In that light, we can now answer the question implicit in the title of this chapter. I asked whether the reason for the failure of North American Indians to domesticate North American apples lay with the Indians or with the apples. I'm not thereby implying that apples could never have been domesticated in North America. Recall that apples were historically among the most difficult fruit trees to cultivate and among the last major ones to be domesticated in Eurasia, because their propagation requires the difficult technique of grafting. There is no evidence for large-scale cultivation of apples even in the Fertile Crescent, and in Europe until classical Greek times, 8,000 years after the rise of Eurasian food production began. If Native Americans had proceeded at the same rate in inventing or acquiring grafting techniques, they too would eventually have domesticated apples, around the year AD 5500, some 8,000 years after the rise of domestication in North America around 2500 BC. Thus, the reason for the failure of Native Americans to domesticate North American apples by the time Europeans arrived lay neither with the people nor with the apples. As far as biological prerequisites for apple domestication were concerned, North American Indian farmers were like Eurasian farmers, and North American wild apples were like Eurasian wild apples. Indeed, some of the supermarket apple varieties now being munched by readers of this chapter have been developed recently by crossing Eurasian apples with wild North American apples. Instead, the reason Native Americans did not domesticate apples lay with the entire suite of wild plant and animal species available to Native Americans. That suite's modest potential for domestication was responsible for the late start of food production in North America. Chapter 9. Zebras, Unhappy Marriages, and the Anna Karenina Principle. Domesticable animals are all alike. Every undomesticable animal is undomesticable in its own way. If you think you've already read something like that before, you're right. Just make a few changes and you have the famous first sentence of Tolstoy's great novel, Anna Karenina. Quote, happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. End quote. By that sentence, Tolstoy meant that in order to be happy, a marriage must succeed in many different respects: sexual attraction, agreement about money, child discipline, religion, in-laws, and other vital issues. Failure in any one of those essential respects can doom a marriage even if it has all the other ingredients needed for happiness. This principle can be extended to understanding much else about life besides marriage. We tend to seek easy, single-factor explanations for success. For most important things, though, success actually requires avoiding many separate possible causes of failure. The Anna Karenina principle explains a feature of animal domestication that had heavy consequences for human history. Namely, that so many seemingly suitable big wild mammal species, such as zebras and peccaries, have never been domesticated, and that the successful domesticates were almost exclusively Eurasian. Having in the preceding two chapters discussed why so many wild plant species, seemingly suitable for domestication, were never domesticated, we shall now tackle the corresponding question for domestic mammals. Our former question about apples or Indians becomes a question of zebras or Africans. In Chapter 4, we reminded ourselves of the many ways in which big domestic mammals were crucial to those human societies possessing them. Most notably, they provided meat, milk products, fertilizer, land transport, leather, military assault vehicles, plow traction, and wool, as well as germs that killed previously unexposed peoples. In addition, of course, small domestic mammals and domestic birds and insects have also been useful to humans. Many birds were domesticated for meat, eggs, and feathers, the chicken in China, various duck and goose species in parts of Eurasia, turkeys in Mesoamerica, guinea fowl in Africa, and the Muscovy duck in South America. Wolves were domesticated in Eurasia and North America to become our dogs, used as hunting companions, sentinels, pets, and in some societies, food. Rodents and other small mammals domesticated for food included the rabbit in Europe, the guinea pig in the Andes, a giant rat in West Africa, and possibly a rodent called the hucha on Caribbean islands. Ferrets were domesticated in Europe to hunt rabbits, and cats were domesticated in North Africa and Southwest Asia to hunt rodent pests. Small mammals domesticated as recently as the 19th and 20th centuries include foxes, mink, and chinchillas grown for fur, and hamsters kept as pets. Even some insects have been domesticated, notably Eurasia's honeybee and China's silkworm moth, kept for honey and silk, respectively. Many of these small animals thus yielded food, clothing, or warmth. But none of them pulled plows or wagons, none bore riders, none except dogs pulled sleds or became war machines, and none of them have been as important for food as have big domestic mammals. Hence, the rest of this chapter will confine itself to the big mammals. These are the ancient 14 species of big herbivorous domestic mammals. The major five. 1. Sheep. Wild ancestor, the Asiatic mouflon sheep of West and Central Asia, now worldwide. 2. Goat. Wild ancestor, the Bezoar goat of West Asia, now worldwide. 3. Cow, alias ox, or cattle. Wild ancestor, the now extinct aurochs, formerly distributed over Eurasia and North Africa, now worldwide. 4. Pig. Wild ancestor, the wild boar, distributed over Eurasia and North Africa, now worldwide. Actually an omnivore, regularly eats both animal and plant food, whereas the other 13 of the ancient 14 are more strictly herbivores. 5. Horse. Wild ancestor, now extinct wild horses of southern Russia. A different subspecies of the same name survived in the wild to modern times as Przewalski's horse of Mongolia, now worldwide. The minor 9 species, 6. Arabian, one-humped camel, wild ancestor now extinct, formerly lived in Arabia and adjacent areas, still largely restricted to Arabia and northern Africa, though feral in Australia. 7. Bactrian, two-humped camel, wild ancestor now extinct, lived in Central Asia, still largely confined to Central Asia. 8. Llama and alpaca. These appear to be well-differentiated breeds of the same species rather than different species. Wild ancestor, the guanaco of the Andes, still largely confined to the Andes, although some are bred as pack animals in North America. 9. Donkey, wild ancestor, the African wild ass of North Africa and formerly perhaps the adjacent area of Southwest Asia. Originally confined as a domestic animal to North Africa and Western Eurasia, more recently also used elsewhere. 10. Reindeer, wild ancestor, the reindeer of northern Eurasia, still largely confined as a domestic animal to that area, though now some also are used in Alaska. This book is continued on Cassette 5, Side 1.